Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There are 217,000 students enrolled in the University of Texas system, served by 19,000 faculty members. In the next year, the leader of that 14-institution system of universities and health institutions will be dealing with the implementation of the legislature's new campus carry law, a $1.7 million study on campus sexual assaults, and the always contentious issue of tuition increases. It may instill confidence to know the man in charge is the same one who commanded the team that killed Osama bin Laden. This is Think on KERA, and we're broadcasting all this week from the studios of KUT in Austin in advance of the Texas Book Festival this weekend. I'm Chris Boyd. Later in the hour, we will speak with Texas Tribune education and political reporter Morgan Smith. For now, I want to welcome my first guest. William H. McRaven is chancellor of the University of Texas System. He retired from the U.S. Navy after 37 years as a Navy SEAL, most recently as the commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, in place to direct the operation that culminated in the bin Laden raid. As it happens, McRaven is himself a graduate of the University of Texas. He got a bachelor's in journalism in 1977 before earning a master's at the Naval Postgraduate School later in his career. Bill, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
Talk about your transition from an institution like the U.S. military to an institution with a very different sort of bureaucracy, but one that has to be understood.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I think a lot of people are surprised by my answer when I tell them that the transition actually from commanding U.S. Special Operations Command to running the UT system was actually pretty easy. I've been running complex organizations for most of my adult life, and you realize it's all about people. You have to understand how to deal with people. And in my last job, I had 12, as we call them in the military, subordinate commands. So as a four-star, I had 12 different commands that were either three stars or two stars, and they were around the globe. And so each one of them had their own autonomy. So you had to recognize and appreciate and respect their autonomy. But at the same time, as the four-star, I was responsible for ensuring we had a strategic approach to dealing with counterterrorism and some of the other issues at U.S. Special Operations Command. I also had a small medical school. I had a small university, admittedly very small. But the issues of accreditation are the same at a university, no matter the size. In medical school, we had to go through a lot of the accreditation issues there. I reported to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which are much like a Board of Regents in that at the end of the day, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman have some say in the issues that we raise. I worked on Capitol Hill quite a bit, so my opportunity to work here with the state legislature was very similar. So the transition for me has actually been pretty easy in terms of moving from the military to higher education and patient care. My toughest issue every morning is waking up and deciding what color tie I'm going to wear.
Suddenly you have all kinds of wardrobe choices.
I do.
There have been three shootings, as you are well aware, on American college campuses this month. And the month is not yet half over. How safe can you make UT system campuses from violence of this nature?
Yeah, we can make them as safe as we possibly can. And by that, I mean we always need to do the best we can to educate our faculty and our student body on how to deal with situations if you have an active shooter. We need to make sure that our police force is prepared to respond to an active shooter incident. And we have to make sure that folks that are out there that see unusual behavior feel comfortable and know how to get in touch with the authorities so that they can report unusual behavior so that we can deal with it appropriately and potentially avert an active shooter situation. But the fact of the matter is, as we have begun to talk more about campus carry, and I know you'll talk about that issue here in a minute, we have to be careful about conflating the issue of campus carry with an active shooter. Clearly, you could have an active shooter case if you had a CHL license holder, but you could just as easily have an active shooter with somebody that just walks off the drag with a weapon in their hand. So we have to be prepared, I think, from a university standpoint, to deal with active shooters, immaterial of whether or not the CHL law had passed.
Active shooting situations are a reality of American life these days. It's not something that many parents imagine, comfortably their students having to deal with.
Yeah, what I would pass to the parents and, frankly, again, to the faculty and the students and others that are coming on our campuses is that we will do everything possible to ensure we have a safe campus without turning the campuses into, as I've said before, kind of a garrison or a military base. We don't want to do that. We want the campus environment to be welcoming. We want to make sure that we are, again, adhering to the law. which we will absolutely do, not only the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. But at the same time, we don't want to create an environment where there is a lot of anxiety when students or faculty or parents come onto a campus. We want the campus to be welcoming, and we intend to make sure that happens.
Do you think Campus Carry will change the culture of schools within the UT system?
Well, I certainly hope not. We are working right now very diligently with the campuses. We have a task force that we have set up. Each one of the campuses has a task force. They meet with my deputy chancellor, Dr. David Daniel, the former president of UT Dallas, every week. They are working through the issues in a very thoughtful manner. And I think we are going to come to the point where we are prepared to, again, ensure that the law is, in fact, followed, but at the same time, keeping everybody as safe as we possibly can and maintaining the environment that we hope to have on a campus.
You have made it very clear you will follow the law. This is not a law that you would have advocated for.
It is not, but as I've said before, one of the things I learned early on in the military is you argue a point up until a decision is made, and once the decision is made, you salute smartly and you move out. We are at that point. The people's representatives, the state legislature, passed this law. The governor signed it. So now we have an obligation to follow the law.
What about student housing? Can you accommodate a student who wishes to live in on-campus housing and not reside in a building where weapons are kept?
Yeah, again, if it's off-campus housing, we have no authority, obviously, over right. off-campus housing. On-campus housing, again, we're working through this with the task force to make sure that that we understand the dynamics of a student having a concealed weapon on a dorm or on-campus housing and how we would have to deal with that. I don't have an answer just yet, but we will certainly in the next several months.
We should be clear that the expansion of campus carry laws extends only to concealed weapons held by people who have to be 21 to get a license.
Or older, correct.
So there would be a lot of students that don't qualify. But do you think the expanded permission for weapons on campus will also tacitly encourage students who don't have a license to carry a weapon?
Yeah, I certainly hope not. And I don't think that will be the case, but it remains to be seen. So I think a lot of this will be a little bit of discovery learning for us in the sense that once the law goes into effect next year, in the beginning of the fall semester, we'll begin to see how it develops. And I think we'll be in a position to kind of adjust. If it looks like we need more gun lockers or less gun lockers, we'll be prepared to adjust to that. If it looks like we need to do more education or we need more support from the university campus police, we'll figure out how best to employ that. Right now, again, I think we're on a very good path to make sure we implement the law within the framework and, again, the spirit and the letter of the law and keep the campuses safe in the environment where we want it.
All right. Sexual assault is a major concern on college campuses across the country right now. I know the UT system is funding a $1.7 million
right.
study on sexual assault, dating violence, stalking, sexual harassment at UT institutions. What do you need that study to tell you that is not already evident?
Yeah, let me digress just a little bit, because when I was in the military, and I've told this story before, but at my 3-star command, I had a force of about 10,000 folks, and we were involved in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world. And I remember my senior enlisted non-commissioned officer, who was a sergeant major, came to me one day and he said, "I think we have a problem with sexual assault within our force." And frankly, I was a little dismissive. I couldn't believe that the folks that we kind of hand-selected and the force that was involved in combat and really focused on doing the mission for the nation would have a problem with sexual assault. But I didn't want to be naive to the fact. So we conducted a survey of our force, and in fact, the results of the survey were eye-opening. And I quickly realized that not only did we have a problem, but we needed to move aggressively on trying to solve this problem. We needed to make sure that the victims felt like they had a good process through which, if they were victimized, they had a reporting criteria that if they wanted to bring charges, they understood what the path was there. Also, if they wanted to maintain a certain anonymity, that they could do that as well, that we would, in fact, respond to the victim's concerns. So there was an education process. There was a number of things, steps we took to put the right procedures in place. And I was pleased at the end of 3 years that I think we had some tremendous results. But it all began with understanding what ground truth was. You know, what were the issues that the victims and the force were having to deal with? When I got to my 4-star command, the military had begun to see this as a problem, a systemic problem across the military, and we began to take very similar steps. So when I came here, I mean, I have seen that in general, I think the campuses do a pretty good job. But I don't have the quality of data or the depth of data that I think I need right now to be able to figure out what are the next steps. So part of the survey, as you know, it's more than a survey. We have a 4-year cohort that hopefully we'll start here in the next couple of weeks, that we will look at their experiences over the course of the 4 years in terms of sexual assault, sexual harassment, and just bad behavior, sexual bad behavior. We want to find out, again, is this systemic? If it is, are we taking the right steps to educate our student body, to educate our faculty, to educate people on what to look for, how to avoid certain circumstances? So I think we're actually going to learn a lot from this survey, and I really appreciate the UT Board of Regents supporting this initiative. It's a lot of money, but it is for a very, very important issue that we've got to grapple with, and I don't think we'll understand the full scope of the problem until we do this survey.
The Bureau of Justice Statistics actually found that the rate of reported sexual assault among women, and we're not talking about men here,
right,
but women 18 to 24, is actually higher among non-students than students. Some people have said that's because students are not encouraged to report to their school administrations and then
right,
also make a separate report to police. Do you think it's appropriate to at least encourage all students who report a sexual assault to folks on campus to also make a separate law enforcement report?
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. And I think this is what some of the study, and you know, we're working with the School of Social Work, I think some of this study will help me understand that. Intuitively, I would say yes. You need to make sure that we have accurate and, if necessary, dual reporting so that the police, not the UT police, but the police department can understand what their statistics look like, and I can understand what our statistics look like. Again, we had the same problem in the military, is that the females, and it was 99.9% women, were concerned about the reporting. They were concerned about their job security. They were concerned about the chain of command. They were concerned whether or not the assaulter would, in fact, be prosecuted. And I think we're going to find similar issues here on campus. However, there's always a good news story when you see as bad as this may sound, that the number of incidents that are being reported is going up, which means that people are more willing to report them. And this, obviously, we don't want the number of sexual assaults to go up, but the reporting criteria, when we see a rise in that, we have to ask ourselves, is this because there has been a rise in the number of incidents? Or is this kind of good news that people are now reporting it more, and therefore we're able to deal with it more quickly?
Do you feel like the university system has the ability to create a culture in which students feel an obligation to take care of one another?
I certainly hope so. And this is one of the things that it has to start with me, and it has to start with the presidents, and it has to start with the student body. They have to take ownership of this problem and recognize that we have a problem, and we cannot dismiss this problem, and we have to aggressively get after this problem. If you understand that, then it's much easier to begin to deal with it. If you decide to be too dismissive of it, or if you look for other reasons why these things are happening, then you will take your focus off the real problem, which is sexual assault. And we can't do that. So we have got to create the right environment. It starts with me. I'm hoping this survey will provide me the information I'm looking for. And then we'll make sure that the presidents of the campuses obviously get all this information and that we start to take steps aggressively to deal with it.
We're speaking this hour with William H. McRaven. He is Chancellor of the University of Texas System. We're talking about the state of public higher education in Texas. We will be taking your calls in a moment on this Week of Think from the studios of KUT in Austin. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll talk about the cost of a public university education in Texas.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of KUT in Austin, I'm Chris Boyd. This is Think. We are in Austin for a week, and my guest for this hour currently is Chancellor William H. McRaven. He's Chancellor of the University of Texas System, retired from the U.S. Navy after 37 years as a Navy SEAL, most recently, of course, as Commander of U.S. Special Operations Command. We're talking today about the state of public higher education in Texas, and if you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5377. All right, on to another sensitive but important topic, this one, tuition rates. The Board of Regents for the UT system voted this month to allow institutions separately to propose increases in tuition and student fees. Why now?
I think because when we look at the statistics of how much higher education costs and how flat some of our incoming revenues have been, we have to recognize that a great education costs money. And right now, let's take UT Austin as an example. We have 14 peer institutions that we measure ourselves against. UT Austin is at the bottom, the very bottom of those institutions in terms of how much money it is in terms of tuition and fees for a student coming in. So a lot of this has to do with revenue from the state, and the state this year was good. We got a bump in our support for formula funding, which we greatly appreciate. But the trend lines over the last several years, the last decade, has been kind of constantly down. State revenues are important for us to defray the cost of a student program. So at some point in time, we have to recognize that education costs money. What we're trying to do here is we're trying to establish a framework through which the campuses can engage their student body. So the only thing the regents have approved at this point in time is this framework. Now, the framework does include a 2% cost of living adjustment, which we think is important. Anything above that, the campuses are going to have to come back to the Board of Regents, and that will happen in February after the students, after the campuses have an opportunity to engage with their students. And then the campuses will have to make their case to the Board of Regents. Each individual campus will have to make their case to the Board of Regents on whether or not they can get any additional increase in tuition. And that will be a very deliberative, very thoughtful process.
Since tuition deregulation in Texas for state schools, tuition and fees have climbed between 40% and 85% at state-run institutions in the state. What's the balance today between what students contribute to the cost of a university education in Texas and what the state chips in?
Yeah, I think you have to be a little bit careful about those statistics because the initial spike was right after deregulation. And so, yeah, absolutely, right after deregulation, over the course, I think, the next couple of years, there was a huge spike. That has subsequently leveled off, and really, when you look across our institutions, for the most part, the University of Texas System institutions have been flat or there have been small increases. In fact, at UT Austin and UT Arlington, for the past couple of years, there have been no increases in tuition. So, again, it gets back to making sure that we understand a couple of things. We have to make sure that a university system, a state system, has as affordable education as we can provide. And we are attempting to do that. But we also have to recognize that a great education requires great money. You are competing with world-class faculty around the nation. You have to make sure that you pay them a commensurate amount to their talents. You have infrastructures. You have student programs that you're trying to fund. So all of this costs money. And again, the only way for us to really generate money is through state revenues, is through tuition and fees. We have obviously some philanthropy and then operating costs that we may generate from athletics and others. And we are always going to do everything we can to keep those costs as low as possible.
Some critics have noted the increasingly lavish facilities on state university campuses, rock climbing gym walls and all-vegan dining halls. Can you give us some perspective on why perks like that get built that arguably don't have a direct impact on faculty performance or student achievement?
Yeah, but I think they are an important part of the student success or student experience, excuse me. So, you know, when you think of a student that you want to come to your campus, frankly, nowadays, we want to make sure the very best students in the state of Texas come to our institutions. And if we are competing against other institutions that, again, while I don't, I mean, climbing walls may be a bit of a reach, but clearly you want to have great gym facilities, great athletic facilities. You want to have great laboratories. You want to have the student experience be the best it can be, because if not, those students will go out of state for that experience. They will go to Louisiana. They will go to Oklahoma. They will go to the East Coast or they will go to the West Coast because they have better facilities there. So, yes, you are to some degree competing for the quality students that you want to get in our institutions. But more importantly than that, it is about understanding what the student experience is today. I will tell you, when I went here to the University of Texas in 1973, we had a gym. We had a gym.
Four walls and a rope.
That's correct. And we had a basketball court and we had intramural fields. Nobody thought about treadmills and nobody thought about, you know, again, kind of lavish, if you will, weight rooms. But today there is an expectation, I think, from our student body that these sorts of facilities are available to them. And, of course, a lot of this, the money that we get for that comes from the athletic program. It comes from other areas where it isn't necessarily a rise in tuition and fees to drive some of those great facilities that we provide our students.
What have been the most striking changes from your perspective in even the city of Austin since you last lived here? I guess you graduated in 77, so it's been a while.
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I will tell you, my sense of the city of Austin is it actually hasn't changed very much. The skyline has changed dramatically. The traffic has changed dramatically. But what is fun about Austin, and I think what has always been interesting about Austin, is the fact that you have this kind of very eclectic environment in terms of you have a great university in Austin, at UT Austin. You have politicians. You have live music. You have all of those things that come together and work very well together in this environment that we call Austin. And that hasn't changed, really, since I left in 1977. That's one of the reasons I love the city of Austin. It's one of the reasons I was thrilled to come back here. Even before I had any thought of taking the job as the UT chancellor, we had intended to come back and live here in Austin because we love the city. In terms of the university, there are, I would say, kind of the same thing. The environment I see around campus today is very similar to the environment I left in 1977. The students are here to get a great education. They love their athletics. They're very proud of being Longhorns in this case. But frankly, I see that wherever I go. I see that at UT Dallas. I see that at UT Arlington. I see that in the Rio Grande Valley. I see that with all of our institutions, that the students that are coming to our institutions want a great education and they want a great student experience. And I think they're getting it around the UT system.
Very briefly, I'm going to assume that your favorite haunt when you were a student here was the library. Is your second favorite haunt still here, and what might that be?
After the library, my second favorite haunt was Gregory Gym. And in fact, I still visit Gregory Gym on the weekends. I'll go down to play basketball. It is, I don't do yoga, I don't do Pilates, but I love to play basketball. So I've enjoyed coming back to Gregory Gym, and of course, not much of that has changed since I left in 77.
Chancellor William H. McRaven is chancellor of the University of Texas System. He retired from the U.S. Navy, and he was in place to direct the operation that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. Bill, thank you so much for making time for us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks very much.
As we bid goodbye to Chancellor McRaven, we welcome our second guest for the hour. Morgan Smith reports on education and politics for the Texas Tribune. Morgan, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Booster's note, a Texas public education is still a bargain. That's what we heard from Chancellor McRaven. Is it affordable to every student qualified to attend college in Texas?
So I think that's kind of the essential struggle that both lawmakers who have been, of both parties really, who have been critical of tuition increase and university leaders who are saying, listen, we need to figure out how to both be able to offer the financial aid that students need to attend our universities, but also make sure that we have, you know, the resources we have to make sure that students get a good quality education once they are here.
Do you think the Texas state university system is providing access to the kind of social mobility that, as you mentioned, people on both sides of the aisle politically are interested in this state, particularly first generation college students?
I think when you look at that, that is something that, you know, affirmative action rules like or rules and regulations that have been put into place in an attempt to create a more diverse student body. I think that that's something that university admissions officials are trying to take into account. But you also have the specter of the top 10% rule, something that has been contentious but has traditionally been used to bring diversity to the school. That's something that might be threatened by coming coming Supreme Court decisions, and also is something that I think lawmakers are looking to address either in the interim or in the upcoming legislative session.
For people who don't know, the top 10% rule was created to sort of de facto desegregate the university, and it allows for students who finish, I think it's lower than top 10% now.
Now it's 7%. Yeah. Right.
But they have automatic, they're guaranteed automatic acceptance into a state university.
That's right, to the university, their top state university of choice. Mm-hmm. And it was really set up so that, students from, varying backgrounds and school districts would be able to come into the campus without setting specific, basically to get around, having to have an affirmative action policy. But yes, that is now coming into question. And so I think there's going to be at least some regrouping around it. And there's also been issues with the rule in terms of students from suburban districts that argue, well, it's much more competitive to be in the top 10% here versus at other schools. So there's kind of on both sides of the issue, there's been some wear and tear there.
So what are the proposals to amend this? What would people who don't like the rule the way it exists now, what do they propose?
Well, I think you have people on, differing camps, but you would have people that would say, well, let's just move to something that is, what people might traditionally think of as affirmative action. You look at students' socioeconomic status, you look into their racial background, and you try and create a student body that has people from all different kinds of backgrounds to kind of in the sense of creating this educational experience that, people... there can be value contributed from people from all different backgrounds. Then you also have kind of the other extreme where the argument is, well, let's just solely look at academic merit in who we admit or athletic prowess, whatever standards you want to set to have, the best and brightest student body, that you should solely just look at what their academic transcript says.
All right, Campus Carry. Are other states actively watching Texas to see what the results of this expanded campus carry permission will be?
I think so. And I think that also that universities within the state of Texas, as they're working to implement this, and really they're developing the rules for this in the next several months, though it's not going to be until this coming school year that this new law will have taken effect. But I think there is another struggle here to balance how broadly and how much control universities have at the local level to be able to interpret this rule. And that's primarily over where are they going to be able to disallow people with concealed handgun license to carry their weapons versus how much control they're going to have over that, whether it's going to be a very strict interpretation or if it's going to be something that's broader, where you might have whole swaths of campus that are prohibited, have handguns prohibited.
We've already heard from some faculty members who've said they're very uncomfortable with the idea of expanded campus carry, having concealed weapons allowed in the classroom. At least one professor has said he will retire before this takes effect. Do you think this will be an issue for faculty recruitment and for student recruitment?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the unseen effect of what this might happen. We are having this kind of second wave of opposition from faculty and students that, may have spoken up during the legislative session, but now that it's really coming home to the campus, there's again kind of another building awareness, and I think that has to be kind of on the minds of higher education leaders as they're figuring out how to implement this rule. Is this something that is going to be able to affect our competitiveness in trying to lure both the top students and the best professors to come to our campus?
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Joanna on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Well, I'm a little concerned. we don't actually get hazard pay, and I don't think we can get 2,000 Kevlar vests. So I think, it is a very big issue, and I think it does set up a very disruptive classroom when you know that somebody might be carrying.
Is that something that you've heard from a lot of professors?
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think that this is something that, you know, lawmakers heard throughout the legislative session when they were crafting and passing this legislation. I think, again, university leaders are hearing this. You know, the common response to that is, well, it's actually going to be a very small amount of students. This is something that Admiral McRaven has said, other university leaders have said. It's actually going to be a very small amount of students who would be carrying, because you have to be 21 or older to get a handgun license.
All right, I want to talk about K-12 education. Texas has been a notable holdout against the conversion to anything like Common Core standards in the state. What are the most significant objections?
So I guess the concern about Common Core, which they're national curriculum standards that are set in both math and in reading, and the idea is that if all of the states are working together to the same standards, that there's going to be kind of a higher quality, uniform education around the states. And Texas has vigorously opposed this, primarily because, you know, there is a concern about federal intrusion into the classroom, and also because Texas has, you know, a long tradition, like some other states, but of really thinking about and putting forth its own, you know, rigorous curriculum standards. And it's been able to do that in part because it has such a large public education system. So Texas has had the liberty that maybe other states don't, in terms of setting its own curriculum standards. Now, that is changing also because of Common Core, because you now have a large portion of other states that are all using these same standards, and that's creating a bigger market that can kind of push back against Texas's leverage.
So we may not want Common Core in the state of Texas, but the issue's not fully over here.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, in terms of whether a school in Texas cannot currently legally implement any Common Core standards, and that's something that's been reiterated both by laws that have been passed and also by attorney general opinion. But I think that there is always going to be a concern of possible federal intrusion into the classroom, because that's just something that our elected officials are very hyper aware of.
My guest is Morgan Smith. She reports on education and politics for the Texas Tribune. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, reporting to you today from the studios of KUT in Austin. My guest for this part of the hour is Texas Tribune education and politics reporter Morgan Smith. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. That's where we find Brett on the line in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Good. Hey, my question is in regards to campus carry, and it's if any of these campuses are actually, you know, asking the students to maybe understand the liability involved with carrying a gun, because I know in the state of Texas you can carry a gun quite a few places, but the law also makes you completely liable for anything that you do with that gun, meaning, you know, if you, let's say, shoot at a gunman or something and you miss and hit someone else, you are responsible for that other person and could definitely, you will face criminal charges in the state of Texas. Now,
thank you so much for your call, Bert. What do you know about that, Morgan?
So I know that liability, you know, the liability associated with carrying a handgun, either openly now that we have that new law or concealed, that topic is something that is covered in the course that you have to take in order to get a handgun license in Texas. I think that universities, that's probably something that they're thinking about now as they're implementing the new concealed carry law is, you know, are we going to integrate the effort to kind of talk about, you know, proper gun safety, what the protocol will be when they are entering these prohibited areas where there will be gun lockers present, presumably to lock up their weapons. You know, to what extent will these universities be going to provide additional kind of information about gun safety, gun laws, all of that? And I don't think that's something that's clear now, but the liability piece is something that is part of the CHL course that you have to take in order to get a license.
Is there much talk about any administrative or campus law enforcement cost associated with expanding campus carry?
Yes, and that's something that was also brought up in a lot of the debate that happened to get this law passed, is that, you know, universities will be facing increased costs just to prepare, you know, not even the you're educating faculty, you're educating students about what is and isn't allowed under this new law, but you're also, you know, facilities wise, you're going to have to put in additional lockers. You're going to have to also train your campus police and how to do it. And there haven't been a lot of hard estimates that have come out about the cost, but that is something that you know, university administrators and also campus police forces have brought up and, you know, is part of the conversation over the implementation of this law.
Before we move on from this subject, this law applies only to public universities in Texas. Are private colleges and universities looking to reflect the law? Do you know whether they're trying to definitely sort of push back against it? What have you seen?
I think that it's kind of varying. I think that if private universities might prefer not to have this kind of debate. I think that it's because it's kind of if from just, you know, purely looking at a university leader standpoint, you're facing a lawsuit either from, you know, possible misuse or danger resulting from having more handguns on campus. But you're also facing the possibility of a lawsuit from someone who feels like their rights have been violated or that you're not properly following the new law if you're overly restrictive in where you can go with handguns. So I think that you know, it's probably something that private universities are hoping that they will not have to have a conversation they're not going to have, but they, you know, if a private university could conceivably decide that, yes, we would like to open our campus to CHL holders, but they, you know, can just as easily say that, no, that's not part of our campus mission. We are going to, you know, continue to have it be illegal to carry.
All right, back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Brad on the line in Richardson. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So
go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I am a part-time adjunct faculty member at University of Texas at Dallas. I'm paid poverty wages to teach, and this is a very common practice both in the UT system and in public higher education in general. And I'm just curious as to how we are going to move beyond this very common practice. 52% of all professors are paid poverty wages to teach, and yet tuition keeps going up. The pay for administrators and the number of administrators keeps going up. And I'd like to hear your guests' comments on that.
Thanks so much for your call, Brad. Morgan, I think a lot of people probably share Brad's frustration.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, it comes at a time when, you know, as tuition has gone up, the state share, you know, the amount of money that the state gives to fund universities of the overall cost, that has gone down. So there's kind of this additional pressure on universities to figure out, you know, how to balance those costs. But there's also a lot of concern about, you know, are universities and other higher education institutions, you know, efficiently and properly using the money that the state is giving to them. You have actually just this morning, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick announced his interim charges for that he would like lawmakers to study for the next legislative session. And there were two or three of them that were related both to higher education spending and also just the costs of higher education and tuition increases. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of discussion on that topic just in general.
Last spring, the Texas legislature approved a plan to rate K-12 schools with an A through F rating to demonstrate how well schools are meeting objectives. What is wrapped up in a school's grade? Is there just one grade?
So there would be a grade for the overall campus. And again, this is, I think, about 2 years out from being implemented. So it would be not this coming school year, but the next coming school year. But then students would, school districts would, and campuses would also get a rating for their kind of, there's like four different subgroups, you know, how well that they're doing in closing the achievement gap between economically disadvantaged students and their peers, how there's improvement. There's also a rating that looks at community engagement. So there would be several different ratings that kind of in the hopes of, while also having it be simple, that parents will also kind of be able to get a fuller picture of what's going on at the campus and what exactly, you know, an A through an F grade actually means.
Why has that measure been controversial?
I think that, you know, just traditionally school accountability and what all goes into, you know, determining whether a school is doing a good or a bad job has been very controversial. I think that in particular with the A through F grades, it's viewed as something that is trying to make something that is extremely complicated, overly just reducing it down to a single letter grade, and that actually is not going to end up helping parents or other members of the community be any more informed about their school, and instead will just, you know, place a stigma if it's a low grade without really helping anyone understand why that grade is low.
You presumably spend a great deal of your time digging through data on school performance. How user-friendly are state-run sites with public data? And I know that the Tribune repackages a lot of this to make it a little easier to find. But for, you know, a regular parent trying to understand the schools in their child's neighborhood, does it take, you know, specialized skills?
Yes. I would say it's, you know, schools do send out kind of little reports to parents, I think, on an annual basis. I think, you know, that's a source. But I think if you're just trying to look statewide, if you wanted to just say, hey, I would like to see the accountability ratings for all of this, you know, not only my school, but all the schools around me and maybe in a neighboring city, that gets very difficult. You know, the state of Texas is great in the amount of data that it collects on students, that it's kind of a great resource for researchers, but it's very difficult. Even as a reporter, I frequently, and you know, as someone who spends time looking with this and kind of following it, it often, you know, takes me a while to find the same rabbit trail I had to follow, you know, to get to the information that I had. But yes, the Tribune, we are kind of working on doing an update to our Public Schools Explorer that will help hopefully have all that information in one very accessible place for people.
What does it take to navigate the difference between understanding education policy and understanding what is working for individual students at the classroom level and what's actually happening on campuses around Texas?
I mean, I think you've kind of gotten right at the heart of why it can be so difficult to, you know, either pass big policy reforms on education or to find something that is, even if it's just a small fix, find something that's a small fix that's actually going to be a fix for all students and all campuses. I think that's something that, you know, is really, I think, why if you hear the argument that the A through F rating or really almost any other accountability label is unfair is because it's very difficult for something like that to get down to the gradation. Okay, there might be a campus that's doing a great job at serving a certain population of students, but, you know, not that doesn't show up across the board. And I think, you know, because it can be, there's so many different layers of both responsibility and then accountability at the state and local level that just can be very much lost kind of in the bigger picture.
We've discussed on the show that I do the fact that there's been a Pew study that says that the superintendent of any district doesn't necessarily have a lot to do with student performance at the ground level. I wonder if you have any insight on the actions taken by the Board of Education, the extent to which that matters in classrooms and affects what students are learning.
So the actions taken by the State Board of Education, mm-hmm. just in
decisions
in general,
made on decisions. Curriculum, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it of course matters just in a general sense, because the State Board of Education is making decisions on both curriculum and, you know, what students need to be covered, what needs to be covered in a certain course, what students are going to be responsible for in the state tests, and then they also approve the textbooks. But I think that increasingly, a lot of the state board's power is being handed down to the local level. So, you know, instead of being forced, for example, to choose from a list of state board approved textbooks, school boards can now either use that list as guideposts, or they could go out and conceivably find their own vendor that they think provides a quality product and vote to implement that at the state level. So, I think it's somewhat changing, but the state board still has a power over a few big picture items that's important and, you know, people should be aware of.
Talk about what you are following most closely for the 2015-2016 academic year. What are the issues maybe that people aren't talking about yet, but that you have your eye on?
So I think that there's kind of this tension and conflict that has been really had the federal government and Texas in this stalemate, though now seems to be moving along, and that's with the No Child Left Behind waiver. And there's been this disagreement that has primarily been over teacher evaluations and whether or not Texas can require all of its school districts to use the same teacher evaluation that in particular includes a metric that's based on student performance on standardized tests. So that's that's the controversial component of it. I think, Texas has recently reached an agreement with the federal government that it has until January to figure this out. But Commissioner Michael Williams has basically said that Texas law does not give him the authority to mandate any type of teacher evaluation system. So, you know, I think in the short term, maybe that's not going to mean a ton of changes at the local level, but I think it is something that we're just going to have to watch to see how it plays out, because that could mean, you know, some big changes for Texas school districts. And, you know, of course, while all of that is happening, we have Congress currently working to revamp that law. So there's a lot of moving pieces there, any one of which I feel like could possibly spring up and become an issue kind of in the next academic year.
We've been speaking this hour with Morgan Smith, who reports on education and politics for the Texas Tribune. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with Chancellor William H. McRaven of the University of Texas System. He stepped out a bit ago. Morgan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd from the studios of KUT in Austin. Thanks for listening to Think, and have a great day.